Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for the Tech Guy on KFI is provided by DSL Extreme at dslextreme.com.
Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my KFI podcast. This show originally aired on Sunday, October 15th, 2006, on KFI AM 640 in Los Angeles. This is show 292.
October 15th, 2006.
KFI is the talk station that does live local news on the hour, on the half, and when it breaks. At 11:06, I'm Ginger Chan, KFI News.
Thank you, Ginger. Good morning, everyone. Leo Laporte, the tech guy on KFI. 1-800-520-1KFI. That's my phone number. 1-800-520-1534. We talk high tech every Saturday and Sunday on this very radio show from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. And high tech means, of course, computers, the internet, cell phones, MP3 players, all that stuff. Home theater, Mac, Linux, and Windows. Vista is a very popular subject. Often talk about that. 1-800-520-1KFI. One of the subjects we should definitely talk about is the new Vista licensing. Microsoft's next version of Windows Vista is about any day now, within the next 10 days, to go to manufacture. They'll start printing the CDs. They'll send it to the computer makers like Dell and HP, and they'll start putting it on computers, and business people will get it next month or the month after, and by January, you'll be buying it on new computers. The new operating system. There are, I think, 7 different versions of Vista. And you may be interested in the limitations of the various versions. If you're going for the cheapie, the $99 upgrade from XP, you'll get Windows Vista Home Basic. Spend a little more, you'll get Windows Vista Home Premium. But you're probably going to want to get Windows Vista Ultimate. Except that, of course, costs a lot more money. And there's a reason for this. It's the license agreements. And this is, we're just starting to see these. It just came out a couple of days ago. And already there's a lot of furor going on about it. Now, I know this seems kind of complicated. And I don't want to get too complicated in here. But basically, the most important limitation, I think, the one that will impact most people, is the limitation on transferring it. I think this is true even of the Ultimate version. You can install it once on one computer. Buy a new computer, you can remove it from the old computer and move it to that computer once, and that's it. Never again. You cannot transfer it to another computer again. You also are limited in if you get the basic edition, you can't copy it to the hard drive. This is really bizarre. You cannot make a copy of the install file. It's just one file now, to the hard drive. Let's see what else. I'll put a link in the show notes to this article from TechWeb. The Microsoft put out the licenses so that people could read them. The first user of the software, I'm reading the license now, may reassign the license to another device one time. If you reassign the license, the other device becomes the licensed device. This is for all versions of Windows. In other words, it can only be moved once, which was not the case for XP. XP, you could transfer it as many times as you want. Another thing that's getting people a little bit upset is they're going to have this validation system and the Windows Genuine Advantage. The thing that's been working so poorly in XP will also be back in Vista. The problem with it is it often flags legitimate copies of XP as pirated. Now, in the past, that's just popped up a notice and kind of warned you and given you a hard time. In Vista, the failure of a validation check results in the loss of access to specific features. Basically, it turns it into a browsing machine and nothing else. You can't run programs. You can't do anything else. The software, this is a quote from the license, will from time to time, probably daily, certainly weekly, validate the software, update or require download of the validation feature of the software. In other words, Windows Genuine Advantage is no longer optional. If after a validation check, the software is found not to be properly licensed, the functionality of the software may be affected. They call this a software protection platform. It'll just be disabled. You basically can use the web browser, and you can only use it for an hour at a time. Now, that's fine if it only happens to pirated copies, but what we're seeing right now with the way Windows Genuine Advantage is working is that a lot of legitimate copies are being flagged as pirated, just, you know, for flaws in the software. Imagine paying for a new computer, paying for Windows, being told that you're a pirate and have it disabled and you can only browse, and there's nothing, and there's no, that's it. Oh man, I could see the lawsuits flying over this. I have a feeling once people really realize the limitations that you're seeing on these licenses, people may think twice about upgrading to Vista, and I'm hoping people will think twice about using Windows at all. There was some talk that you couldn't use virtual machines either, unless you had Ultimate, and that's unclear. They've removed that from one of the articles. Ed Bott at ZDNet did a really good analysis of it. And I'll put a link in the show notes to that. Oh, by the way, the show notes are still down. We're almost done transferring over the server. There's still some issues. But we're waiting for the DNS to propagate. That's the technical term. Basically, some of you will be able to get there, some of you won't. And eventually that'll all be, next hour or so, that'll all be fixed. I don't know. It's just, I think that when Microsoft starts to get really nervous about piracy, which they have been since day one, there's a famous story of Bill Gates in the very earliest days of Microsoft when it was just a few employees going to the Homebrew Computer Club and railing against them for stealing the paper tapes of his BASIC. You're pirates. You're all a bunch of pirates. He's felt this way from day one. People are stealing my stuff. But as I've talked about before, as you get tighter and tighter on your restrictions on what people can do, at some point people rebel and say, I'm not going to take it anymore. And I think I wouldn't be surprised if Microsoft's finally pushed it to the limit. People are going to really want to read these license agreements before they buy an upgrade to Windows Vista. And I think some people may really decide not to use Windows at all, but just go to Linux, where you have a completely free hand to do what you want with the software. Blogs.zdnet.com. And look at Ed Bott's Microsoft report. Ed's a good guy and has kind of gone through it and analyzed it. The loss of features if you fail validation. They have increased the warranty from 90 days to 1 year. Oh, whoopee. What does a warranty mean in software, really? If it's broken, we'll fix it. I don't know what a warranty in terms of software means. This one-time transfer, though, I think is gonna bite people. And they're putting in hardcore piracy checks to to enforce it. It's not just a good idea. This is the way it's going to be. You can sell it once, and the next person can't sell it again. You could transfer it to another machine once, and that's it. Now, what happens? XP has been in 5 years in between. So it's fine. If you only use two different computers in those 5 years, you only upgrade once, that's fine. You buy a third computer, you're out of luck. You need a new license for Windows. I guess most people, when they buy a computer, they get Windows with it anyway. So it's only really going to affect people, the geeks who build their own computers, things like that. Nevertheless, I think it's something to pay attention to. I don't know. Maybe I'm full of it. Maybe this is no big deal. No problem. What do you think? 1-800-520-1KFI. Interesting story going on around Apple's store in New York City, the one with the beautiful glass cube. A kind of a site that I think is basically got a pretty strong bias. The Middle East Media Research Institute it's a group that supposedly translates Arabic media into English, is saying that Muslims are somehow offended by the glass cube at Apple's New York City store, saying it looks like the Kaaba, that's the house of Abraham, and it is sacrilegious. Now, you may have seen this story on ZDNet and other blogs, news sites, and so forth. But according to a number of other blogs, wait a minute, a lot of Muslims say, what? This is just trying to stir up anti-Muslim hatred. And I'm looking at one blog, the Apple Gazette, where a number of Muslims have posted saying, "What's this is crazy. Nobody's saying this." Interesting, though. Here's one. Lena says, "I am Muslim and I'm an Apple fan to the core. I remember seeing pics of the new cube being built with the black covering over it, and it instantly reminded me of the Kaaba, but I don't think it's offensive. It was just a coincidence. Apple has been using cubes as part of its marketing. We Muslims do not own the right to the cube shape, so why be offended?" So the Muslim community is coming back and saying, no, this is not true. So it looks like somebody's using this to try to stir up some stuff. Some other stories in the news I mentioned. Did I mention this yesterday? The Red Nano? Oprah and Bono got together to create a special iPod Nano. It's bright red. It's to benefit Project Red. Every Red Nano sold sends $10 to Project Red, which is Bono's project to end AIDS in Africa. It's a bright red iPod. Very pretty. And Oprah bought 10 in the Chicago Apple store, which to Oprah is probably, you know, cigarette money. I don't know. I guess she probably gave them away. What do you think? E3 is back. We were talking about this a while ago, the gaming convention that took over. It was originally at the Anaheim Convention Center. They moved to L.A.? I think they moved to the L.A. Convention Center. And it used to be the big deal. Oddly, a couple of months ago, said, we're not going to do it anymore. It turned out the big gaming companies, Sony, Microsoft, Nintendo, all decided not to participate. That was it for E3. Without the biggies, there's no show. Well, now E3's announced that they're going to become a summer show. The next E3 will be July of next year in Santa Monica. So no more LA Convention Center, a much smaller venue. It'll be at the Barker Hangar at the Santa Monica Airport. We'll have meetings there. This is a step down a little bit, it sounds like to me. Okay, I may be wrong. It's really going to be more focused on meetings and not a show as it used to be. It really was a fun show. It was a party. But the gaming industry decided, we're not selling any machines here. This is just people partying. So they pulled out. Now E3 is a bunch of meetings in an airport hangar. 1119, let's take your calls. 1-800-520-1KFI. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy on KFI AM 640. More stimulating talk radio.
What's hot this year? Morality. Dr. Laura. Tomorrow, noon to 3.
KFI. AM 640.
KFI. AM 640. More stimulating talk radio. Leo Laporte, the tech guy on KFI. 1-800-520-1KFI is my phone number. 1-800-520-1534. I'd love to hear from you. Rob, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. You're first on KFI. Hello, Rob.
Wow, what a privilege, Leo. Thank you.
Oh, it is mine. All mine.
The privilege, I
have a question.
Yes, sir.
I have a question.
Yes, sir.
I'm interested in, perhaps, if I decide on some content, I'm interested in producing podcasts of my own.
Who wouldn't be? It's so much fun.
Oh, it's so much fun listening to them, especially yours.
A huge opportunity.
I don't have enough time to listen to all of yours, but I do.
I don't have time to make them all. I don't blame you.
I know. T. Morris's book, Podcasting for Dummies.
Yeah.
He talks about the need for a quality audio card. What's the difference between an audio card and the regular sound card?
Same thing.
Mind you, I've gone to the store, the big box store, And as soon as I said the word podcast, they want to direct me over to the Macintosh aisle.
Oh, yeah, and that really makes me mad. That's one of the reasons I'm trying to change the name to Netcast.
Yes, I know.
There's this strong association with Apple, which doesn't help podcasters at all. Mm-hmm. And when you go to a computer store and they say, oh, you have to have a Mac to make a podcast, it's like, come on. No, you don't.
Yeah, they should know better.
They should know better. You don't have to have a Mac to listen to a podcast. You don't have to have a Mac to make a podcast. There doesn't have to be any Apple anywhere in there. I kind of blame Microsoft for not putting podcast support in Vista. I think part of the reason they didn't is because they can't use the word podcast, because Apple is kind of asserting its right to the word pod, particularly in association with hardware. So they don't know, you know, what are they going to call it? That's why I'm really trying to create a little groundswell behind Netcast, so people at least have a word that's not an Apple word that somebody like Microsoft can use. I don't expect it to replace podcast, but let's have a second word that people can use. So, do you need a sound card? No, you don't even need a sound card. It depends how you're going to record your audio. A sound card is the same as an audio card. If you're going to use one of the cheap mics, which I don't recommend, that comes with your computer or that you buy that plugs into a sound card, yes, then you need a sound card. But that is the worst way to record audio, because an analog connection into a computer is going to have all sorts of noise, buzz, hum, hiss. You're not going to get good quality. First thing to consider is going out and getting a USB headset for your record. You need a mic, right? So this is the first thing, is a USB headset. The reason is USB is all digital right into the computer. And so you don't get a lot of the noisy artifacts that you do from an analog input. And they're cheap, $50. I recommend a Plantronics DSP model, either the 400 or the 500. The quality, they're good mics on there, and because it's USB, they're good quality. That's kind of the easiest, cheapest way to go. There are some companies that make USB microphones. Samson makes a very good one for around $80, Samson. There's, if you want to spend a little more money, there's the Snowball, which is a fantastic microphone for about $150. Or you can do what I do, which is use a Pro mic. I use the same Heil PR40 Pro mic that I use for right now for the radio show. I use for podcasting, and you just have to have an interface to the computer. This all presumes, by the way, that you're recording on the computer. You don't even have to record on the computer. You could record on a standalone device and just put the data into the computer.
Are you acquainted at all with the product of the Alesis, A-L-E-S-I-S?
Yeah, the Alesis is a great product. That is a device that takes an analog microphone, turns it into bits, and then passes it into the computer either via USB or FireWire. And Alesis makes very good.
This particular one is USB.
Yeah, they make very good hardware.
Headphones and a mic. I don't know.
Hang on a little bit. I think this is a good subject to go into a little bit more, and I want to make an announcement about a new show that we're going to do that might help you. So stand by. We have to take a break for news. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, KFI AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. It's 11:29. Ginger Chan is in the KFI News Center.
Taking no prisoners. John and Ken, tomorrow, 3 to 7.
KFI, AM 640.
11:37, KFI, AM 640. More simulating talk radio. Leo Laporte, the tech guy on KFI. I'm talking to Rob in Milwaukee. He wants to do a podcast. And I thought it'd be worth spending a little more time on how to do a podcast, because everybody should do a podcast. Just everybody should do one. I mean, if you've always thought, I should do a radio show, I could do what Leo does, I could do what Bill Handel does, I could do a radio show, I could do, I could read my favorite book out loud, or I could sing a song, I could play my music. That's what it's all about. And it's really easy to do. You don't even need a computer. It helps. Really, kind of the minimum really would be a computer, an internet connection, and a website, or somewhere at least on the web that you could store this stuff. The truth is, Rob, you could even go to somewhere like Libsyn, which is a web hosting company specifically for podcasters, Libsyn.com.
Yes, I know. And they don't restrict your bandwidth.
Unlimited bandwidth. So if you get really popular, if you become the next big thing,
costs you
nothing more. Yeah, I use Libsyn for a number of my podcasts. The nice thing is that the maximum is $30 a month, and that they have much lower prices. And it's based on how much disk space you use a month. That's
right.
And then they provide you with a website. So, you know, and the feed and everything. They do all the hard stuff. So that's a good. And there are a number of companies coming along the pipe, I think, that'll do something like Libsyn. People are looking at Libsyn saying, that's a good business.
You were going to answer about the Alesis.
Yeah, the Alesis is an interface. And there are a number of interfaces. M Audio makes one called the Fast Track. Alesis is really high quality. I use a Motu Mark of the Unicorn, a Traveler. Mark of the Unicorn makes a couple of these. All these do is, they're kind of doing what the sound card does, really. But in reverse, they're, well, actually not in reverse, exactly what the sound card does. They take the analog input from a microphone, and they turn it into bits, and then they pipe it into your computer. And when you're spending a lot of money on something like a Lessis, which is hundreds of dollars, or a M-Audio Fastrack, you're getting much higher quality analog to digital conversion than you get from a sound card. And it's outside the computer, so it's in a quieter environment. It has other benefits. You can use real mics. You know, my mic doesn't require power, what they call phantom power, but many mics do require phantom power. They have to be powered. Your computer won't do that. But these devices like the Alesis, the Fastrack, and others will have phantom power, which means that you can use a condenser-based mic. And those are good sensitive mics, and in some environments, they're better choice than the dynamic mics that I use. In a quiet environment like a radio studio, a dynamic mic is a good choice. And as far as recording, Audacity, which is free, is fine. GarageBand, if you have a Mac, works great, but there are plenty of, I use a Windows program for all my recording and editing called Audition. It's from Adobe. It's a little expensive. It's $300, but it's based on a radio station program. A lot of radio stations use Audition.
The Alesis comes with the Cubase.
Cubase is great. Yep. Now, the Alesis may be overkill for you. That's a multi-track recorder. Cubase is a multi-track recorder. It means multiple microphones. Each track will be recorded separately. So you can have, I don't know how many inputs on that Alesis. Is it four? Depends.
Eight.
It's eight
channels of input mixed down to stereo through USB.
Right. What you want to look... Oh, it's mixed down to the USB. Okay. So then you don't get the multiple channels. Some devices will allow you to get each channel separately. And then, I mean...
It says it can send up to two tracks.
Yeah, two's plenty.
That's stereo.
Two's plenty. The question is, do you mix it down in the Alesis or do you mix it down in the computer? When we go out in the field, I use a Mark of the Unicorn Traveler, which is, now this is expensive, it's an $800 interface, but it has four mic inputs and then four other instrument inputs. You could record a band on it, and the beauty of it is each of these goes into the computer via FireWire separately. So I record using Cubase up to eight separate tracks, which means I can then mix it later. I don't have to, when you're mixing it down to stereo in the box, you have to get all the levels just right, because you can't separate them out. Does that make sense? We're starting to turn it into a music recording studio here.
But a garage band.
A garage band. But are you just talking a voice podcast?
Yes.
I think the best way, if it's just your voice, or is it multiple people?
Well, I'd like to do some interviews, maybe.
Okay.
But I do have that Alesis I'm talking about.
Oh, well, then
it's
great.
It's in
the
box right next to me. It's got this handy little carrying case.
Oh, you got you. So you, when you went to that store, they sold you something good.
eBay,
baby. So what Alesis did you get?
It's the USB podcasting.
Oh, it's a podcasting station. How interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's great. I think you're set. And did it come with microphones?
One of them, a dynamic one.
So then you might get one more microphone for your guest.
Right.
Get a stand so you isolate the microphone. You don't want to be holding it.
There's one stand.
Good. So you get another mic, another stand,
and
another
headphones.
Mic cable, and you got headphones. You got a studio. And that's the beauty of this. How much did that cost you?
That was $200. Just $200.
Amazing. Mm-hmm. That's the beauty of it. You have a professional-grade recording studio right there.
Wow.
And you record in a Cubase, you mix it down, and you turn it into an MP3 because nobody wants to download a giant WAV file, but you turn it into an MP3.
Right, and I can do that with my iTunes.
Absolutely. And you're done. Then you upload it to Libsyn, and you've got a podcast. It's really simple. Now, I said I'm going to make an announcement. We do have a new show that we're going to be starting soon called Gear Media Tech, GMT, and it's going to be all about, this is the subject of it. It's the reason I want to tell everybody about it. It's going to be for people who want a podcast, and we're going to review all the technology, all the equipment, show you how to use it. It's going to be a fun podcast. It's video,
You're
by the way.
You're doing another podcast?
No, please, I know.
What is this, now 16?
the good news on this one is Alex Lindsay over at the Pixel Core is doing all the production. I'm just going to be on it. I'm helping him out with it. So I don't have to do all the work. But yeah, what's interesting is the podcast network that I have, Twit, which started with one podcast and then another one and another one, and it's now up to quite a few, more than a dozen. I've lost count. And we're adding more all the time. We're adding other people's associates' podcasts. Eventually, this is going to be, probably there'll be 20 different shows on there that you can go, some video, some audio, all about technology. And I'm excited. I mean, it really is, to me, almost like a little mini radio station or a little TV station of just
a little network.
It's a little network focused on technology. It's essentially trying to recreate Tech TV, which is the network I work
for. Now, if you get the trademark that you've applied for the word Netcast.
We haven't done that yet. We're considering it. I don't want to own it, and that's why we haven't done it yet. I want, before we go, it's $30,000 to do the full trademark, to do it right.
Really?
Well, because lawyers are expensive, and you have to do it. I mean, I've done trademarks for $600, but I didn't do the trademark search and all that stuff. But if you really do it right, to make sure that it is a clear, clean trademark, it's a lot of money. Now, we have a very generous angel who's agreed to pay for it.
Dick DiPietrola.
No, he's not that. Not Dick, but it's somebody anyway who has some money, and he realizes that this is an important thing, and he's willing to pay for it. He has the lawyers. The issue is, it wouldn't be right for me or any individual to own it. We'd be right in the same boat we are with Apple. I'm waiting for a podcast industry consortium. A couple of people want to start one up. Once there's a trade group that can own it, that can be, in effect, owned by all podcasters, Netcasters. Then I would. And a lot of people say, you never get rid of podcasts. And I agree, we won't. But I just want there to be an alternative that's at least somewhat understood, that isn't so closely associated with Apple. It isn't owned by Apple. And, I don't think Apple's going to ever shut me down for saying the word podcast. I'm not worried about that. I'm more worried that companies like Microsoft might just avoid it because they don't want to get in the battle, right? And yes, we need Windows to support podcasting. All right, I'm going to get off my high horse. Nobody who's listening is that interested in podcasting. Rob, good luck with yours, though. Good luck with yours. I think it's great. Mark, Hillsboro, North Carolina, KFI, Leo LaPorte, the tech guy. Hey, Mark.
How you doing?
I'm well. How are things in North Carolina?
Wonderful. High 60s is beautiful.
Oh, it's a beautiful part of the country. Really gorgeous.
Yeah, it is. It is. Speaking of iTunes and podcasts.
I can't get away from it. All right.
I listen to, my podcast on a Sliver, one of the Motorola phones.
Yeah, a lot of people are starting to do that.
Well, that's perfect. You've got a 100-song limit.
Perfect, yeah.
And I've got two micro SD cards I switch out.
So you got plenty of space on there.
Plenty. But when I upgraded to iTunes 7, I made a smart playlist that shows all the podcasts.
Right.
But the new podcasts, as they come in, do show up in the whole music list. But the older ones that are in the smart playlist don't, which means I can't delete them.
So when you sync up to the Sliver, you're syncing just the smart playlist?
I pick the ones manually.
Okay. So you actually create your own little playlist for the Sliver?
Well, which you build manually. It shows all of the non-video podcasts.
Got it.
All the ones that are MPEG.
And then you have a separate folder that's your Sliver sync folder, and you copy the ones you want into that?
Right. Yeah. And then once I copy it over, I used to delete the ones that I copied over.
But now you no longer see them?
I see them. Well, I would delete them, so then when I hook the phone back up,
right,
it
takes them off.
It would automatically delete them off the phone.
Right.
And now it keeps them in the playlist, and they are not there. The new ones are there in the main music menu, which is the only place you can delete them.
Well, understand, when you delete them from a playlist, you merely delete them from the playlist, not the file itself.
Right. But it won't let me delete them from the playlist either, and they don't show up in the music thing. It's very, very bizarre.
So they're not in the library, the podcast library, or the music library.
The podcast library, doesn't that just show the subscriptions and such?
Yes. Yes.
Okay, so it would not show me...
It wouldn't show you just random items.
Right.
You know, they changed, you're right, they changed the way that happens in 7, and I'm not sure exactly what's going on, but I don't like it. They've categorized stuff, and it's, movies, TV shows, and podcasts are all categorized, and audiobooks are all categorized now, and moved around. I would say that it's probably, I would look carefully in your settings for your iPod, Make sure that you are, you know, aren't doing something that you don't expect. You got to, it's kind of a complex ecology here. So you've got to look at your smart playlist, make sure it's doing what you want it to do. Look at your podcast syncing, which has changed considerably in version 7, and make sure it's doing what you want to. I think it's probably the settings, your sync settings. If you have said, please only synchronize stuff in this folder, it will only look at that folder. If stuff's removed from that folder, regardless of whether it's still on iTunes or not, it won't. It'll remove it from the phone. Sliver is an iTunes capable phone, so it's able. Unlike, you know, it's like basically like an iPod. And then, there's one other option you might need or use to your benefit, which is only sync checked songs. So another way to get rid of stuff would be to uncheck it, not delete it, not remove it from that playlist. If it's stuck in that playlist, in a smart playlist, it might be. It's going to keep populating it, right? Just uncheck it. If you uncheck it, it won't sync it. I'm not sure. It's hard for me to visualize what's going on. So those are some things to look at. I'm not sure if those will help. But it's hard for me to exactly see what your problem is. So that's where I would look, though. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, KFI, AM 640. More stimulating talk radio. It's 1150.
Outrageously entertaining. Bill Handel, tomorrow morning, 5 to 9.
KFI, AM 640.
1157, KFI, AM 640. More stimulating talk radio. Clayton, Newport Beach, welcome to KFI. Hey, Clayton.
Hi, Leo.
Hey.
I'm calling about the announcement that Intel made about this November 13th rollout of this quad-core chip.
Yeah.
And I'm reading about it, and I'm not sure that it's a real... Yeah, is this a real quad-core chip? And yeah. Do you think that we're going to see a January Macworld announcement of a Macintosh with this chip?
Well, you know, an interesting thing. Anand Tech took the Mac Pro that's shipping right now, the one I have, with Woodcrest chips in it, popped the Woodcrest, put the Clovertown in, and it saw all 8 processors. They all worked. It worked fine. It was an incredibly high-end, very fast machine. So they're pin compatible with the existing Mac Pro motherboards. And by the way, that's very common. I thought, well, that's weird, because in the desktop market, you see every time a new chip comes out, they change the pins, right? So you can't do that. But it turns out that the people who buy servers won't put up with it. These are all server chips. And they say, no, we want the upgrade. So Clovertown, the new 4-core processor, is exactly that. It's 4 chips on one die, just as the Core Duo and the Core 2 Duo are 2 chips on one die. And it is going to be pretty remarkable, and apparently it will work just fine with existing Mac hardware. So will Apple announce it? Maybe. They could. But you know what? One of the reasons I bought a Mac Pro is when I found out I could do that, I don't even care if they announce it. If I want more headroom at some point, if I want an 8-way processor, I could do it. Pretty amazing, isn't
it? Yeah, that is amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, that they could put that on the motherboard. I read this on Macworld, which is why I was curious about it. And they're saying that AMD is going to be coming
That's
out
right.
with a competing chip.
That's right.
And that theirs is a true quad core, but the Intel chip is 2 dual cores glued together.
Well, I am not an expert enough to know the difference. I know it shows up as 4 processors. AMD, you know, we'll see what they do. They say early 2007, but AMD is not an issue if you're a Mac user. Apple's made the commitment to Intel, and I don't think you're going to see an AMD chip in an Apple. You know, I'll have to look into that. Everybody I've talked to says Clovertown is a true 4-core processor. That's the first I've heard that it might not be a 4-core processor. I mean, 2-core duos is 4 cores. So I'll look into that. But as far as I know, that's it. Yeah, that's what you're getting. 4 processors in 1 chip. Amazing. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, KFI AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. It's 12 noon. Lisa Osborne's in the KFI News Center.
October 15th, 2006.
KFI is a talk station that does live local news on the hour, on the half, and when it breaks. It's 12:06. I'm Lisa Osborne, KFI News.
KFI, AM 640. More stimulating talk radio. Leo Laporte, the tech guy on KFI. 1-800-520-1KFI is the phone number. 1-800-520-1534. We're talking about the new Windows licensing in Vista. We're talking about, well, anything you want to talk about having to do with computers. 1-800-520-1KFI is my phone number. There's always something to talk about in the world of technology. That's why I love it. E3 moving to Santa Monica to an airplane hangar. Firefox 2 almost out. IE7 almost out. It's a little controversial. At first, it sounded like Microsoft was going to push IE7 out last Tuesday as part of its updates. Now it turns out, yeah, they will push it out at some point. You're going to get an update. You'll reboot your PC sometime probably in the next month. You'll reboot your PC and it'll say, I've just downloaded Internet Explorer 7. Would you like me to install it? It won't force you to install it, but it will download it automatically, regardless of your update settings, by the way. And regardless of whether you have automatic installation. So expect sometime in the next few weeks to get that message in the morning. And I would suggest you install it. I do a Windows Weekly podcast with Paul Thurrott, who's a Windows expert, and I asked him. He said, oh, no, you should install it. Secure, much more secure, some nice features like the tabs. I've been playing with it for a while. It's certainly reliable and robust. I've been using the beta for quite some time. I had some issues with it working on my website with some cosmetic things, but somebody gave me a fix. So I have to do some special IE7 code on my website, but it now works right. I imagine there are a few websites that don't work quite right, but for the most part, IE7 seems to be an improvement. Is it more secure? I don't know. You know, part of the problem with Internet Explorer 6 is just, you know, flaws in the way it's written. We don't know if IE7 has been written better. I'm sure they've applied all the fixes from previously, but I imagine it's much of the same code as IE6. So, yeah, there are probably still lots of security errors in there. And as everybody moves to Internet Explorer 7, the hackers are going to do the same. And I wouldn't be surprised at all to see the same number of problems surface with Internet Explorer 7. On the other hand, we haven't had a new version of Internet Explorer in years. It probably is time to update it. It's certainly a more modern browser. There's lots of nice features. So Paul Thurrott said, say yes. I've been using it for a while. It seems fine to me. I'd say yes. Certainly, it's not going to be any worse than IE6 was. So look for a new browser. You could be like Steve Martin. The new browsers are here. The new browsers are here. Vic Glendale, KFI, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hello, Vic.
Happy afternoon.
Afternoon.
I am calling about something that you had talked about, I think, a couple weeks ago. It was the Sanyo HD1 all-in-one camcorder and
exactly.
Still camera.
Yeah.
Yes. And I looked it up after you had enthused about it. And I actually know somebody that bought it, and there seems to be lots of issues.
I was talking about the 1A.
The 1A, okay.
So don't look at the 1 reviews, the 1A.
The 1A has resolved a lot of these issues because...
Well, what are the issues? You tell me, and I'll tell you if they're resolved.
Okay, well, it seems to be like they fall into three main areas. First area seems to be a lot of error messages. It gets real buggy when switching between functions.
Haven't seen that at all.
Okay, a lot of system error messages. The second seems to be absolutely lousy performance in anything besides bright sunlight.
Well, now that's true of many digital cameras. I wouldn't say lousy, but it does get grainy when it gets dark. But that's true of a lot of digital cameras. It's
you know, I understand that, but the reviews I've seen says to the point of grainy would be unusable.
That was not my experience. But now you really, again, the 1A is a completely different camera. So that's the one I was looking at. I did not look
all
at
right.
the 1.
Okay, not the 1. And the main point seems to be, and this was borne out by a friend of mine, and I honestly don't know if he had the 1 or the 1A. I'll have to ask. But the main point seemed to be that the failure rate or the failure of the LCD screen seemed synchronized with the expiration of the 90-day warranty.
That often seems to be the case, doesn't it? Now, the 1 was using an OLED screen, a very beautiful OLED screen that they are not using in the 1A. So my guess is your friend has a 1.
Right. Right.
And that's why they stopped using them, because they changed they changed from the OLED to a standard LCD in the second edition.
And did they also, now this could be also like card error, but it also, there seems to be reports that anything bigger than a 1 gigabyte card seems to be very, very buggy in this
I'm using
camera.
A 2 gigabyte card. Now, another feature that's new in the 1A is the ability to read these new 4 gigabyte cards. So they've certainly changed the firmware about card reading. I did experience one problem at one point with corrupted files, and I'm not sure it. Well, I wasn't doing the recording or pulling off of the files, and I'm not sure if the person who was doing that unplugged it while it was reading and maybe caused some problems. I reformatted the card, and I haven't had that problem again. So,
That's the other thing too. Is that does the 1A still require you to format the card in the before you use it in the camcorder?
It didn't when I put it in.
Because that's another issue that I read about the 1A is that you have to format the card in the camera before you use it, or it won't read or write to the card.
I took it out of the package and put it in the camera, and it worked right out of the box.
Well, you know, it sounds as though, like, you know, that's an important point then, that
there's 1A. A significant difference between the 1 and 1A. The 1A just came out. Now, I've only had it for a month, but I haven't had... Then there are a few other things they fixed that maybe you didn't read about, but one of the real problems with many of these is they're so small and light, it's very hard to hold them steady. In the 1A, they've added optical image stabilization that is significant.
Yeah, I did read that, but most of the time that I would be using it, like at least half the time, this would be on a tripod or a monopod, so that's really not an issue. But I'm looking for something that, like, I can take hiking, and I've got, like, one of those staffs got the top screws off that you can screw a camera onto it, a standard base.
I'll tell you, if you're in the outdoors, it's going to look great. Now, you know, if you wanted really true high def, you'd go out and you buy one of those Sony or Canon HD DV camcorders, and you'd really get really good high def. This is compressed MPEG-4, so there are artifacts, there's jaggies and so forth, but it's very lightweight.
This is something that I primarily want to be able to take with me. I do a lot of hiking. I like the idea of taking something along with me that I can slip in my pocket, because at the end of the day, everything you put like gains like 10 times its weight when you're coming back as opposed to when you were starting out. So
isn't that the
this
truth?
Was like a solution for me.
Well, yeah, I wish you could try it before you commit to it, because it's certainly not perfect. For instance, the stills, even though it's a 5-megapixel camera, are not as good as a digital still camera.
Right.
I've been a little unhappy with that. But in many ways, I think it is kind of, you know, the first decent solid-state camcorder. I mean, that's to me what was significant about it.
But the significant point, though, is that there is a significant difference in the 1 and the 1A.
Yes, they should have changed the number. They should have called it the 2. It is not the same camera.
So I should be looking at the 1A and not the 1 when I'm considering that.
Absolutely. I would absolutely stand by that. The 1 had a lot of failings. I think the 1A fixes... As far as I can tell, that's certainly all the ones you've talked about, but except for the low light. I will grant you. Now, it's not unusable. It's just grainy.
Well, you know, that's going to be like, you know, I mean, that's not going to be very much of a factor.
No, you're outside. Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know,
it is a factor, though. A lot of people use camcorders to, you know, for birthday parties and things like that.
Right.
And indoors is low light, and many camcorders do badly in low light. That's very common.
I know, except you know, Sony's got got that down. I think as far as you know, that would be it if they included something like Sony's night shot capabilities.
Well, understand all that is they're projecting an infrared light.
Yeah, you know,
so they're lighting it. You just can't see the light.
I know that's
everything's kind of greenish, right? Everything's kind of greenish. What's sad is the low light capability really is a function of the size of the pickup chip. And as these cameras have gotten smaller, the companies have just reduced the size of the chip to a sixth of an inch, and it's so small it doesn't have enough area to pick up enough light. And it's just that's just the way it is. And so that's the price you pay for a really compact camera, I think.
Right, you know, I mean, at night, this, you know, I would probably use this as a still camera, and it's got a built-in flash.
It does have a flash, yeah. The flash does not work for video, but only for Right. Stills.
Yeah, but for like snapshots at night, that would probably be my night using that would be my night using thing. So that would be just fine. So I'm really going to take a second look at this now.
And I hate to, I don't want to be responsible for something that you really hate, but I have to say it doesn't have the failings that you've heard so far. I wish there were a way you could try it. Because that would just really be a great thing to do. We have some video posted. That we took on Call for Help. Sean Carruthers took some video on Call for Help, and I have to see.
Do you have an URL for that?
If I can find it, I will tell you. Okay. I'm going to look for it. I'll tell you what. Let me look for it in the break, and I will find it. And then you can see at least a little bit. It's not the world's best shot video, but you'll see at least a little bit of the quality of it, which is surprisingly good.
Oh, I really appreciate you clearing up the differentiation here, because that was really like a concern for me, and I'm glad. I mean, I'm taking this as like not like gospel from you, but if there is a significant difference, then I will take a another look at this.
I did not play with the one, so I don't know the difference between the one and the 1A, but I have given it to people who have had the one who didn't like the one, and they said, "Wow, this is much better." One thing that you give up is you don't have that beautiful display anymore. The OLED display that was in the one is gone. They now use an LCD, but now we know why. It was failing. Thanks for the call, Vic. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, KFI, AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. It's 1218.
You tip your waiters. You tip the valet. So why not tip your favorite radio station? Call the KFI News tip line. It's always open at 323-CALL-KFI.
KFI, AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. Scott and Dana Point, welcome to KFI. I'm Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hey, Scott.
Leo,
thanks,
hi.
Thanks for hanging on.
No problem. just had some thoughts when you were talking about Vista earlier and the problems with
new licensing and the Windows.
Chintzy,
yeah.
Chintziness.
Chintzy, yes.
Anyway.
Paranoia, more like.
Paranoia. Well, yeah. Anyway, and I was thinking that he's got into this mode Gal helped me with the word earlier, of giving away his money.
Yes, he's doing that right now. Bill Gates is donating huge amounts of money.
Right, and I'm thinking, okay, public relations, great idea.
Are you saying he should donate Windows?
Well, if he would just put some of that effort on the front.
I understand what you're saying. Yeah, if he were a little less. Now, I have to say, first of all, Microsoft's a publicly held company, so Bill Gates has a responsibility to the shareholders to maximize value.
Right.
If you'll forgive me some business boilerplate, so he can't just give it away, or even. Now, I happen to think, and I think that the world's going to come around to this, it's good business. The stockholders should demand a little bit less copy protection, a little bit less paranoia, because what that does is, first of all, it treats your customers, your most valuable asset, as criminals. And that's not good. When I go to a movie and they accuse me after I've paid $9.50 of being a pirate, that is not good for business. So I think that's the first thing businesses have to realize is when you are turning legitimate customers into treating them like criminals, you're turning them into criminals. You're teaching them how to pirate. You're teaching them how to get around these things. You're teaching them to hate you. It's bad business to be so tight-fisted. And in fact, we know this. This has happened again and again. These things go in cycles. Early in the software industry, a lot of software was copy protected. It didn't work.
That's pretty much, you said what I have in mind. I just can't say it, but that's what I meant to put out there was is better to treat people with some dignity.
I agree. I think
on the front end.
I'm really getting more hopeful that there's going to be a rebellion we consumers. I think so, aren't we? We're getting fed up with this stuff.
I just switched to Apple.
Yep.
I mean, I got to tell you,
Apple might end up being just as bad. They do copy protection with their music and their TV shows, as of yet, they do not copy protect their operating system, mostly because you guys still got to buy a computer from them to use it, right? But I could see Apple, any company, getting like this. What we've got to do as consumers is really make it clear to the companies it's bad business to treat us like crooks.
Right.
And
right.
We will not take it.
Part of what I was, you know, what came to mind as I was thinking about this was I don't know what happened between him and Apple a long time ago. I just know what, you know, some of the shows that they put together have portrayed him like. And I'm thinking, what I've seen there is that he basically pirated what he, you know, some of what he got in the first place.
I don't really blame anybody for that. I mean, yeah, a lot of people said, hey, look at Vista. This is just a ripoff of OS X Tiger. In many ways, it is. But, you know, that's fine. That's called cross-pollinization. Okay. It happens in the industry. Apple has sued Microsoft. Microsoft has sued Apple over these issues. But the truth is, that's good for consumers. If there's a good idea in user interface, you don't want it patented and owned by just one company. You want everybody to do it, so you have a choice. Mm-hmm. So I don't mind. In fact, I think it's a good thing that these companies come along and they steal, quote, ideas from the other companies. And I don't believe in software patents for that reason. You know, that's something that's been going on where a company says, no, we figured out, for instance, Amazon says we own the patent for one-click purchases. Well, now, fortunately, they haven't enforced this, but do you think only one company should be allowed to do this? No, this is a great feature. Other companies should be allowed to do this. It's good for consumers if everybody can do it. So I don't mind Apple borrowing from Microsoft. I don't mind Microsoft borrowing from Apple. That's good for us. That's a good thing. I'm just really hoping that the companies are going to start to realize that the most important asset any company has is its consumers, its customers, the people who buy the products. Stop treating us like crooks. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, KFI, AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. 1229, Lisa Osborne's in the KFI News Center.
Listen to KFI live online 24/7. KFI, AM640.com.
KFI, AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. Leo Laporte, the tech guy on KFI. 1237 now. Great to have you here. I'll be here till 2 o'clock this afternoon, and then it's Dr. Dean Needell on the world's greatest radio station, KFI. Just what I needed. Arnie Palos Verdes, welcome to KFI.
Thank you, Leo.
Thank you for hanging on so long.
Yeah, well, I grew a few more gray hairs while waiting.
I'm just a windbag. I'm sorry.
No, I enjoy listening to your help.
Thank you.
Anyway, my issue has to do with the Firefox.
Okay.
Over a year ago, when you first made mention of all the holes that Internet Explorer has, I still kept it as my default browser.
Okay.
However, I've been using Firefox pretty exclusively. About 2-3 weeks ago, upon logging on to Firefox, there was a message saying that there is a new upgrade.
Yeah.
And do I want to download it? Which I did. And that's when I began having problems with it.
That's when my troubles began.
That's when my troubles began, exactly. What is happening is... first of all, it asserted that even though I kept IE 6 as my default browser, but I was using Firefox pretty exclusively and using IE only for the Microsoft downloads. Now that Firefox has asserted itself as my default browser, and I can't seem to get IE 6. To be my default.
Yeah, you have to tell IE to it's in the internet options. You have to tell it.
No, I've gone into.
It won't do it. It won't do it, huh?
No, it will not. I've got it checked in the appropriate box in internet options, but Firefox is still asserting itself. The having with it is
You press the button that says make IE the default browser in the internet properties. And, you know, sometimes what happens is a bookmark, even though your default browser is still IE, if you create a bookmark with Firefox, it will open itself in Firefox. So that might be what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but that's a minor one. What other problems do you have? Let's see if there's something more serious here. We can fix those.
Well, whenever I access a website... that is going to come through on Firefox,
yeah.
I get a pop-up message. I'm just trying to recall exactly what it says. Just bear with me one second,
sure.
Please.
What's the gist of it?
Well, the gist is that I get a pop-up message.
Is it unhappy? Is it saying, I don't want to show you this site? Is it saying, I don't work with this site? I mean, is it not working? I don't need the exact wordage. I just need to know what it's doing.
Well, I get a message that says a script on this page may be busy.
Yeah, yeah. That's become a problem lately with Firefox. Is this annoying? And I find it very annoying. And
it's not affecting not affecting my logging on, except that it's an extra step I have to go through. I have to click on the stop script. The continue doesn't do one bit.
Yeah, it's this unresponsive script thing, and it was a bug that was introduced in 1.5, and I don't know if they fixed it in later versions or what. But I could tell you how to fix it. It's kind of a complicated thing, but. This is the gist of it, and we have it in the show notes from a couple of weeks back because somebody else asked this question. In Firefox, you're going to enter an unusual address. The address is no HTTP, no www, no colon slash slash, just...
Could you repeat that a bit more slowly?
Well, I haven't said anything yet. It's just about colon config. So there's nothing... You know, I'm just saying there's no HTTP. It's just about colon config. And what this is the advanced configuration features for Firefox. So it's not really a web address. It's telling Firefox, open up your configuration page, about colon config. When you do that, you're going to see three or four or five pages, hundreds of settings, but the one you want is under dom. I know, I wish they made this easier. max_script_run_time. You're looking for DOM max script runtime. And what this is the value before you start getting that unresponsive script warning. How long does Firefox wait? The default is too low. And I think that's what happened is that there was an error in 1.5 and they made it just 5 seconds. Well, many scripts take longer than 5 seconds to run. So you get this warning after 5 seconds. That's too quick. So let's set that number to a higher number. 20 is a good choice.
I heard you mention this a couple of weeks ago.
That's right. We talked about this before.
And I did change that setting.
Oh, you did?
Yes, I did, and that didn't seem to help.
Well, make it bigger.
So what I did next, I uninstalled Firefox and then reinstalled it.
Yeah.
Same problem. Uninstalled once again and then reinstalled. Same problem.
Yeah,
Seem to get rid of that.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to go away. I would just say make that number bigger than 20, and make sure you're doing it to the right place. It's got to be dom.maxscriptruntime.
Right.
And as far as I know, that gets rid of it. It is kind of an annoying bug. I think the other thing to do is see if there is a more recent version of Firefox out there.
This was supposed to have been the latest.
Yeah, let me just see what the most recent one I have here is. 1.5.0.7. And it will automatically update you. There is another possibility. Let me see here. I'm just looking at the Mozilla forums where they talk about this stuff. Do you run an extension called AdBlock Plus?
No.
Okay. That's another source of this problem.
Is there perhaps a phone number for Mozilla Firefox?
No, it's a free program. They don't offer any support.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, when you don't make any money on a program, although they make a lot of money just between you and me, but they don't charge anybody money, so they don't really feel too compelled to offer support. It's an open source project. You can go to the Mozilla forums. You know, go to mozilla.org, and there is support there, but it's not. It's usually from just other users. But you'll find if you go there, a lot of people talking about this unresponsive script. Now, see, it went away on my system. Let me just see what my setting is, because I didn't change it. I don't think. Maybe I did, but it went away on my system, and that's why I thought maybe they fixed it in a later release, a later patch. Let me see, Dom. Max script runtime. See, minus 10. And I haven't seen that error in ages. Now, it may be that you go particularly to a page where there are slow scripts. So you might want to set that number higher. The forums, Lifehacker and others say 20. Hey, try 45. Try 90. It doesn't hurt to have a large number there. You'll certainly get rid of it if you put 90 seconds. So again, about colon config, and then scroll down to DOM max script runtime. Just double click it. It'll ask you for a new value. Put 90 in there. That means it's going to wait a minute and a half before it gives you that warning. Most scripts come back faster than that. It's probably the case that you're visiting a site where the script, or you frequently visit a site where the scripts are slow. They're doing more. And this is the kind of thing many programs have. It's called a timeout. Not the kind you give to your kids. A timeout is when something takes too long to respond. The computer has to give up at some point. And you see this happen all the time. And a good timeout length of time is important because you don't want the computer to give up prematurely. You don't want to see those error messages too often. But at the same time, you don't want it to hang up waiting for things to happen. So every program has to be tuned a little bit to make the timeout appropriate. For instance, your modem, the timeout before it gives up when it doesn't hear a dial tone. You don't want it to wait an hour, but you don't want it to give up after a second either. And so that's almost every computer process has timeouts of some kind or another. They're just designed so that the computer doesn't get hung up waiting for something to happen, that it can gracefully exit out of it. John in Diamond Bar, KFI, Leo LaPointe, the tech guy. Hey, John.
How you doing, Leo? This is John Diamond Bar. Having trouble with the Windows briefcase.
Oh, yeah, the Windows briefcase. What a piece of junk that is.
Oh, man.
Can I give you a suggestion for something better? How about that? Windows briefcase has never worked right. So what's the problem?
Well, my wife has a laptop and a desktop, and she works on files between both computers, and I want to have her just drop her laptop on the docking station and then synchronize everything.
You'd think that Microsoft, when it shipped something called Briefcase, would make it work. It's never worked. They've dropped it in Vista. It was a bad idea to begin with. Let me give you a better program. How about that?
That'd be awesome.
So I use, first of all, Microsoft does have a free program called SyncToy. If you do a Google for SyncToy, it'll be the first item on there. It's Microsoft SyncToy for Windows XP. It does the same thing. It's free. But I also have used for many years a program called Second Copy, and I really like it. It's not free. It's shareware. It's from Centered Systems, centered.com, C-E-N-T-E-R-E-D.com. Excellent tool. Uh-huh. These are synchronization tools, so they automatically copy the make sure that the folders match, right? That's what you want to do with Briefcase. So if she's worked on something on the laptop, it automatically gets copied to the desktop. If she's worked on something on the desktop, it automatically gets copied to the laptop. The latest versions of every file are on both, right?
Absolutely. That's what I want.
Yeah. And that's what everybody wants. That's called, you know, synchronization. And Briefcase, which promised to do it, never did. Now, let me keep looking because on Call for Help, Mike Lazazara, one of my co-hosts on Call for Help the other day found a free program that does the same thing that he really liked, and I don't remember the name, and I'm gonna check for you, and I will say that on the air when we come back, because there is a free program that he says is just dynamite, and I was very impressed with it. And of course, being an elderly person that I am, I have no memory whatsoever of the name, so I'm going to see if I can get him and find out what the name of that was. Leo LaPointe, the tech guy, KFI, AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. It's 1248.
What do you get when you mix more stimulating talk radio to your weekends? Duh.
More stimulating weekends.
KFI, AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. I am Leo LaPointe, the tech guy on KFI. Darn it, I cannot find this great synchronization program, and Mike is not on his instant messenger, so I can't get to him. But as soon as I can find it, I'll put it in the show notes. By the way, the show notes are still down, but they're getting there. They're slowly coming back up. The website's working and everything. It's just a matter of I moved it to a different hosting service, so it takes a little while for the domain name to propagate. In other words, for many of you, it's leoville.tv, which is the real name, is pointing to the wrong location. But it will soon point to the right location, as soon as that information percolates through the internet. And Leo.am, which is the one I like to use because it's short and sweet and kind of implies AM radio, that goes through the Armenian domain name registry. That's who owns .am. .tv is owned by the island nation of Tuvalu, which is, I think, in Polynesia. So apparently Tuvalu wins. If you had a race between Tuvalu and Armenia, Tuvalu would win. Although probably neither country actually manages these things. Well, actually, I think Armenia might. I think when I've contacted them, I've actually contacted somebody in Armenia. They own .am. Just as we own .us in the United States, they own .am. So one of the domain names, the one I like to use, is leo.am. And since it's now pointing to a different server, I have to change the directory entry for it. And I'm just waiting. You know, it's probably midnight in Armenia. I don't know. They're not awake. I don't know. I'm waiting. But I'm sure in any minute now, they will point it to the new servers. And then once they do it there, at their end, in the master phone book maintained by their registry, then it has to percolate down through all the other registries. So it takes a while. It might take as long as 24 hours before Leo.am works. But Leo.tv does work now, with some minor flaws. I'm still working on it. It's hard to do a radio show and maintain a website at the same time. Wendy, Mission Viejo, welcome, KFI. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Mr. Leo.
Yes.
How are you?
Hi, Wendy. I'm great. How are you?
I'm pretty good. Oh, wow. I'm so happy to talk to you. I got to tell you, you are my hero.
Oh, you're so nice. Thank you.
And I have a question for you. Actually, a couple questions for you today. I have some friends of mine whom I set up a small office network for using a Linksys wireless router. One PC is connected via Ethernet, doesn't have a wireless card.
Okay.
And the other two PCs are connected via wirelessly using WPA encryption.
Okay.
And I want to know what you think would be the best way for me to set up for them to be able to access files from one PC to another. Would it be best to, I mean, is there a little like FTP server program?
Oh, you don't need to do that. I mean, doesn't file sharing work for you?
Well, I don't know how to set that up for them. See, I just did it as a favor. And
I understand.
Really,
is it all Windows?
Yes,
oh,
all
yeah.
XP Pro.
So if you just do a help for file sharing, you'll see that it'll actually walk you through step by step. You'll turn on file sharing. The big issue sometimes is security. If you've got firewalls and so forth in between the computers, sometimes that can impair file sharing. But really, it's quite simple.
Well, just the router. I mean,
but the router's outside protecting them from the outside world. They talk to each other directly.
Okay.
So I wouldn't even worry about that. And so once you turn on file sharing, and then you go to My Network Places.
Simple file sharing?
I would turn on... Well, yeah, you can... Yeah, it's good to use the full file sharing, but the help file will walk you through that. Then you go to My Network Places. You'll see the other computer. You'll see whatever folders you shared, and you log into it using a login for that other computer. So that's how you set up these accounts. You can create a new login or you can use an existing login. And then you can even go a little farther. You can map the drive, which means it'll always mount, and you do that in the Explorer window. There is a map command. It's right under Tools, map network drive, and so it'll give that drive a letter on the other computer. So, you know, his Z drive will be the other computer, and he can copy files to it and from it, and it mounts every time you boot the computer up. It really is a simple way to do it. I could give you more details, but it's all documented in the help file. It's totally the easiest way to do it, and I do it all the time. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, KFI AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. 12:59, Lisa Osborne is in the KFI News Center.
October 15, 2006.
KFI is the talk station that does live local news on the hour, on the half, and when it breaks. It's 107. I'm Lisa Osborne, KFI News.
Thank you, Lisa. KFI AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. Leo Laporte, the tech guy on KFI 107 now. I'll be here till 2, Dr. Dean Adele, but I'm here every Saturday and Sunday from 11 to 2. So if you don't get through this hour, just call again on Saturday. 1-800-520-1KFI. Next Saturday, I'll do what I did this Saturday, by the way, and keep the calls going till 4. That's next Saturday. We're recording ahead for some vacation time. I'm going on a geek cruise, Mac Mania 5. Can't wait. That'll be a lot of fun towards the end of the month. If you've never done one of those, you've got to come with me. I go on a lot of geek cruises. The next one is in February to the Caribbean, and it's a Vista cruise. Lots of experts. David Pogue from the New York Times, staff and editors from PC World Magazine. And I'll be talking about Vista security, migrating to Vista, and Vista software, you know, shareware gems. It's going to be a lot of fun. I'm really looking forward to that. I do these, you know, because partly because I get, you know, a free cruise, but mostly because I really love the conference. I take the other people's classes. I learn so much, and I love the people who go on them. It's just great to hang out with all of these geeks. Mac Mania is so much fun. I mean, it's just a bunch of Mac people. You can pretend on a Mac Mania cruise, you can pretend that Mac's market share, the Apple market share, is 100%. It's a brief fantasy, but a lovely one. Mike in Orlando, KFI, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hello, Mike.
Hey, Leo. I think that I am victim of interference from a neighbor's pre-in router.
Yes, yes. That can absolutely happen.
What do you do?
You go knock on their door. You say, give me that router. There's a big issue. This has happened before. There were routers being sold a while ago that had a special accelerated technology. And what people found out is that they did it by eating up all of the channels and all of the bandwidth so that no one else could use a Wi-Fi router anywhere near you.
Right.
And now pre-N, the original N was pretty good in that respect. It used something called MIMO. Multiple in, multiple out, and it claimed, and I think this was true in the earliest ends, the pre-ends, to be interference-free. But the folks who do the Ergo chipset, which is one of the companies that makes, and I think makes the only good N chipset, and the folks who make the other company, Broadcom, who make the less good chipset, have been in kind of a battle. Broadcom has apparently managed to change this spec enough to, and this is in the draft end spec, to cause a lot of interference. And Ergo has said, this is bad now. This is a bad spec. There's a lot of interference. It's a big issue. So it wouldn't,
yeah.
If they had a pre-N router, it probably wouldn't be the case. But if they had a, did it just start?
It just started about, almost a month ago.
Yeah, that's right, when the draft end routers started to come out.
And it's only certain times of the day. I've swapped out my cable modem.
I have the same problem. I know when my neighbors are surfing because my Wi-Fi stops working very well.
Yeah. And it'll log back on in 2 or 3 minutes and then go off a few minutes later.
Oh, I hate that.
Yeah.
So,
is there anything, even a new router with that? I mean, what fixes it at this point?
It's a really good question.
I don't know who it is. So,
it's a really good question. A couple of things you should try is different channels.
Okay.
You might find there's a channel that's less susceptible to the interference. You know, you have 11. So
right.
Most people just leave it on either the default channel, which is often one, or auto.
Yeah, it's default right now.
Yeah, and so it might be worth just, you know, trying other ones. It also would probably be worth repositioning your access point. This stuff is a black art, radio frequency,
right.
and avoiding interference, and it's a lot of it is just trial and error.
Okay.
Or you could put tin foil on the wall between you and your neighbor.
I've tried that.
Have you?
Yes.
You're kidding.
I mean, not a lot of. I tried like kind of shrouding it just to see my wife and my daughter think I'm nuts.
As long as you don't make the pointed little hat, I think you're all right. That's how you can block a Wi-Fi signal is not with tinfoil so much, but with what they call a Faraday cage, which is really essentially a screen,
right.
A metal screen, a copper metal mesh. It was very effective at blocking those waves. I don't know what the answer is. I mean, this is a big battle
right.
going on, and it's held up the ratification of the N standard because Ergo's saying, no, this is a terrible spec. This new draft N is bad. Broadcom's saying, we can work with it. It'll be fine. And they're fighting it out. We expect that there'll be ratification sometime early next year, but the question is, will they change the standard, or will they go with this standard that is very prone to interference?
So even buying a new router, I could still be in the same situation.
Well, you'd be, fighting fire with fire.
Yeah.
I don't know if it would fix it or not. I certainly hate to go out and buy a pre-end router just to find out that it didn't do anything.
Sure. Yeah.
Or drafting, I guess, is what you're looking for. Do you use G?
It's a G.
Yeah. See, they're all on the same unregulated frequency, and that's really part of the problem is there's no regulation of the 2.4 gigahertz band. And in fact, I remember talking to the FCC, chairman of the FCC, and asking him, well, you know, it's unregulated. Does that mean my neighbor can, you know, put in a transmitter at 2.4 gigahertz and stop my Wi-Fi from working entirely? He said, yeah. He said, what could actually happen? One of the things we really fear is some manufacturer will come out with some new device at 2.4 gigahertz that effectively jams all of the other devices, and there's nothing really you can do about it.
Right.
It's the Wild West. So, you know, one thing you could do is go to an A router, which would definitely fix the problem. That's at a 5 gigahertz frequency.
Do the new Mac support that?
I think they do. I remember you should check, but it was kind of a surprise. They never said they supported. They support N too, apparently. They never said they supported it. But most chipsets support B, A, and G. You should check and see. You have a new Mac?
My daughter does. Yeah.
So that's the question: is it going to support A? The problem with A is it's faster, but its range isn't as good.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a tough one. I mean, one thing you could do is buy a new router for your neighbor and put it on their doorstep. Say, here.
Yeah, I don't even know who it is.
Yeah. I have the same problem. I have exactly the same problem. And I think I know who it is, but I can't be sure. And that's the problem. You know, in most neighborhoods now, you have 4, 3, 4, 5, 6, maybe more Wi-Fi signals. And I think that's starting to happen. We're all starting to interfere with each other. So my suggestion, repositioning your access point and trying different channels, doing a little trial and error, and just cross your fingers.
I'll do that. Hey, Leo, my wife will kill me if I don't ask you a question.
Sure.
She wanted to ask you if you know can suggest a service or software that you can receive email receipt confirmation.
No guarantee. No, there isn't, because you can't tell how somebody's going to receive it. So I turn off receipts. I don't like sending out receipts. And so you can't force me to. You can't make me.
Right.
And there's no service that can make you. So
she has a business. She's seeing her actual clients, and they're like, oh, I didn't get the email when she sent it out. Grr. So just, I don't know if there was something available like that.
Yeah, I mean, there was, but it's kind of nefarious. There actually is. It was, let me see if I can remember the name. It was kind of a clever idea. Essentially, you sent out HTML email with a invisible image in it, a 1 pixel by 1 pixel image, and you could tell if they'd opened it or not because it would ping back to the server. Now, it may not work anymore because of the danger of embedded images. Outlook Express, both will not display images anymore. Gmail won't display images anymore. So I think that company's probably gone. I'll see if I can find them. They had a funny name like, I got your mail, or you know, who got my mail, something like that. And in order to do it, you have to send HTML mail. Your client has to receive HTML mail. Not everybody does. And they have to use an email client like Outlook or Outlook Express or Gmail that doesn't block images. And, you know, frankly, most of these do now because it's so dangerous. So I'm afraid I don't know of any solution anymore. That was why I'm sure this company came up with this. It was a year or two ago. It was a clever idea.
Yeah, because I've seen some services online that say they provide that, but I don't know how.
That's how they do it. That's how they do it. Yeah. They embed an invisible image and that comes from their server, right? So when you look at the email, the image is downloaded from their server. It's invisible, so the user doesn't see it. But their server says, ah, he's looking at the email. Aha, he's read it. It's still
Leo, this is Kim. I'm Mike's wife. I just have to tell you, I'm such a big fan.
Thank you.
Big fan.
Oh, that's great.
Not interested in computers at all, but I have to tell you that every time, I'm a jewelry designer, when we drive home from art shows, we listen to your shows, and I thoroughly enjoy them.
Oh, aren't you sweet?
Thank you. Just wonderful.
Why do you enjoy it? It's all about geek talk, and you're not even interested in geek talk.
Because I understand it.
Ah.
Because you make it so that I can understand it, and
good.
That is a huge thing.
That's my mission.
I really, really enjoy it.
Mike, Kim, nice to meet you.
You do a great job.
Thank you. Bless
nice
you.
Nice to meet you, too.
All right.
Thanks.
Take
Bye-bye.
Care. Sorry I wasn't much help in either category. That's my mission, my goal in life, my dream and desire is to make technology accessible. Because I just think it's so, first of all, I think it's cool. I love it. You know, I love playing with it. But more than that, I think it's really powerful and useful. And we're all living with it. I think it's very important that we understand it for a couple of reasons. One, so that we can use it. We can be effective. We can be more powerful. Our voices can be heard. That's why I love podcasting. That's why I love blogs. It gives everybody a voice. But there's another, even maybe even more important reason, the political reason. Computers can be used against us, as we know, by spammers, by advertisers, by people trying to invade our privacy, ultimately even by government. And for that reason, it's really important that we understand technology and we own it. We take control of it. It's ours. It's not theirs. And the more we understand it, the better able we will be able to fight these invasions of privacy, these copy protection measures. The people who want to, you know, they're trying to pass laws. The content creators trying to pass laws that force every digital device to have copy protection built into the hardware. They want it. The motion picture companies, the recording companies want to be able to reach into your computer and delete files if they don't like it that you've got them. See, we need to know this so we can fight it, right? That's my goal, to give you the power, but also to give you the understanding so that we can keep the power. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, KFI, AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. It's 119.
It's Handel's world. He just lets us live here. Tomorrow morning, 5 to 9.
KFI, AM 640.
126, KFI, AM 640. More stimulating talk radio. Danny, Hacienda Heights, Leo Laporte, welcome to KFI.
Leo, yesterday one of your callers had a question about he wanted to have his cell phone called if there is an incident.
Yes.
He's talking about a boat, and you weren't sure. There is a technology called telematics that's been around for quite a while.
Okay.
It's GPS-based, as well as cellular phone, or, you know, used to cell sites. And it's used for security and other tracking reasons.
I've heard it used in that's used when they track trucks. UPS trucks use telematics.
That's the technology. It's used in different fashions, but one of the features that it does do, especially for the consumer, it will call you. Usually has two different phone numbers to call and also email you if there's an incident.
So how do you implement that?
Well, it's a unit and it has an antenna, so that's how it transmits and receives. And then it'll call two numbers and email you, and then you have an incident report through the email. And you can also track it on email if you're not
OnStar. OnStar is the telematics most people are familiar with.
Well, yeah, but what this is it's a
It's a reverse OnStar, although OnStar will do that too. OnStar, if you have an accident, will call GM.
Well, yeah, but that's kind of a locked-in, you know, where this has, you can have negative triggers. Basically, with a relay or a module, you can have it do pretty much anything you want. For instance, like the guy came up with some outrageous thing with a boat sinking.
He wanted
some sort of device.
You'd have to have a device. A boat sinking, exactly.
It'll trigger the unit, and then it'll call you.
So he has to jerry-rig something up that detects moisture.
No, not necessarily. I mean, boat sinking, I mean, there may be some sort of device, but let's say you're a car.
Actually, I have
let's
seen
a guy opens your car door.
There you go.
It'll trigger
right
away, and it'll call you literally within seconds.
Have you used any of these? Do you know who makes them?
Oh, yeah. I sell them. I've used them. Probably the best place to get, especially in Southern California, is a company called DLC, David Levy Company.
Okay.
Either easily, you know, just do a search on, I think it's DLC Parts, but do a search, David Levy Company. They're local in Southern California. I'm sure you could buy it directly for them for a few $100.
Excellent.
And then they have an expert there that can tell you how to pretty much operate any other device you want to hook up to it.
Excellent, Danny. I'm so glad you called. Telematics is the answer.
Yeah. And do me a favor. Frances, my lovely wife. Veronica, Vanessa, Victoria, I love you guys.
I'm glad to do that. All right. Take care, Danny. I really appreciate it. That's one of the great things about doing this show is the great body of expertise out there. So the fellow wanted, he called yesterday, he wanted a way to rig up his boat so when if it got wet, it was taken on water, it would call him. And I actually have seen devices like that at boat shows. So I know you can buy something like that where it calls you if there's water in the hold or whatever. He also wanted his car to call him if it got stolen. And a DLC, David Levy Company, it's telematics. And, the name telematics I knew from OnStar, which is one form of telematics. So now I realize you can do a lot more with it. That's very cool. Really appreciate that, Danny. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, KFI, AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. It's 129. Lisa Osborne's in the KFI News Center.
The truth hurts. She'll tell you anyway. Dr. Laura, tomorrow, noon to 3.
KFI, AM 640.
KFI, AM 640. More stimulating talk radio. Leo Laporte, sporting a black flag sticker on my Cadillac. Derek in Oceanside, welcome to KFI.
Yeah, hi, Leo.
Hi, Derek.
I've got a 20-inch iMac, and I wondered if I can buy cheap memory for that, or am I stuck with the Mac memory?
No.
You said something in the... Go ahead.
Yeah, you generally don't need to buy the Apple memory. The only time the Apple memory is a must is on these new high-end Mac Pros, because Apple's done something unusual with the RAM. They've got special heat sinks and so forth. And so for that special RAM for the Mac Pro, Apple... is as inexpensive as everybody else. But for every other Mac, including the iMacs, absolutely you can save money. There's two good places to go for Mac memory. I go to a company called Trans International, TransINTL.com. And they have very affordable Mac memory. It's absolutely compatible. I've been buying it from them for years. So I know that it's completely compatible and completely safe. The website's a little tough to navigate, but it's pretty, but it's just got a very strange way of finding stuff. But if you go to TransINTL.com, you'll look up your particular model, and you said you have the iMac. It's the
20-inch iMac.
The G5 or the dual core?
Dual core.
The new one?
Yes.
You are lucky man. And let me just see. I'll tell you what the price is. For 2 gigabytes, it's $249. For 1 gigabyte, it's $139. So considerably less than what Apple charges. And it's absolutely the same memory. Apple's memory is no different than anybody else's memory.
Okay, very good. I'm sitting in a restaurant right now, so can you put a link on your site to it so I can check it out later on?
I will, absolutely, although it's going to be a little while because we're still having trouble getting the website up. But the minute it's up, Trans International will go up there. Just remember, TransINTL.com, and I think it's a really good place to buy Mac memory. Enjoy your lunch. I'm sorry I kept you on hold for an hour at the restaurant. Poor guy. That's just mean. I'm just mean. Dan in Oceanside, KFI, Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, Leo.
Hey, Dan.
How are you?
Great.
Hey, you're the best. Thank you for what you do.
Oh, people are awesome. Nice today. Did you all take happy pills today? What happened? I don't understand.
Yeah, this is all the Leo fan club.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
I travel a lot, and I always try to find free Wi-Fi. And in many cities, I'll find a network named Free Public Wi-Fi.
Really?
And I can connect to it fine. But I can't get into the internet.
Well, so much for that.
So what good is it?
You know, here's the thing. I can put up, I can just take a Wi-Fi access point and turn it on, and you'll see it as Wi-Fi. If I don't connect it to the internet, you won't be able to get out onto the internet. You'll just be able to log onto that access point. So now, why is that said? I've never heard of such a thing. I'm thinking...
It's in many cities, I find that.
I'm thinking if I'm a bad guy... And I want to get into people's computers. I set up a Wi-Fi access point. I name it Free Public Wi-Fi. I turn it on. and then as soon as they log into that, right, they basically have allowed me to join their network.
Mm-hmm.
And then I can try stuff. I tap away as quickly as I can until they realize there's no internet access there. Actually, if I'm a good bad guy, I put some internet access on there, then you'll never get off of it. So maybe that's not, maybe okay. It isn't something nefarious, but the point is you can have an open access point that has no internet access, and it's not going to obviously do you any good.
Yeah.
You know, the number one internet service provider in the country is named Linksys. Whenever I'm driving around and I see a Wi-Fi access point named Linksys, I know they haven't changed anything, right? It's still the way it came out of the box.
Yeah.
And people do that. I don't blame them. They open the box, they plug it in, and it works. They don't go any farther. But what they've done is they've broadcast their internet access to anybody who wants it. So I don't know who this Free Public Wi-Fi is, but I'd be suspicious.
Yeah. Hey, well, you opened my eyes, I think.
Tunstoffel. You know what Robert Heinlein used to say? There's no such thing as a free lunch.
Yeah.
Now, many municipalities are starting to offer Wi-Fi, and that, you know, is a great thing. You know, you go to Huntington Beach, you go to various locales in New York City, San Francisco, and you're going to find free Wi-Fi. Often it will not be called free public Wi-Fi, but sometimes maybe it will be. If you're getting 4 bars or 5 bars, you've got a good connection to it, and you're still not getting internet access, then there may be some other thing that you're supposed to do or expected to do to get it. When you open your browser, it just says nothing. It doesn't give you a sign up or a...
Yeah. Okay. No, it's just that error message. But when I go into the status, the activity, the sent, it does the normal activity on the sent, but there's no activity on the receive.
There's nothing coming back, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's probably not a bad guy. I mean, who knows? But, I mean, really, if you're a real bad guy, you give them internet access because you want to keep them on there for a while until you can capture everything that you're interested in. So, you know, that's why I use VPN when I get on open access points, because I just don't know what's going on with that access point. I don't think there's a configuration issue, but there might be some something that you're expected to do. Maybe the municipality that offers this free public Wi-Fi put a notice in the paper saying, oh, and by the way, your DNS has to be set to a certain number. That would be one way to do it. Yeah. There are generic DNS servers that you can always try. That might, you know, here's how the internet works. So it's several steps. So in order to get onto this access point, I log in, it synchronizes, it shakes hands. Now I'm on, but I'm not on the internet yet. I enter in an address. Let's say I go KFIAM640.com. What has to happen now is a signal has to be sent out to the domain name servers, and it says, oh, that number is, and it gives me back a number, and then it surfs to the website. It needs a number, not a name, for the website. So if, for instance, and this can happen, you log on to an access point and it doesn't properly configure your DNS, or you don't get a DNS address, then you won't be able to look up any names, and you'll get exactly what you're seeing, which is nothing. So you can use a public DNS server. There are numbers of public DNS servers. That might be one way to see if that will work. Let me give you I'm just going to look up real quickly some addresses that I can give you.
Okay.
If you do a Google of public name servers, you'll find the same information.
Public name servers.
In fact, there's a whole list of them. Just Google it. I'm not going to start giving out numbers. But, and you can use these. You can even use them on your own home network. You know, normally your internet service provider gives you a pair of numbers that are your domain name servers, where you'll do the lookup. The ISP runs those, but you don't have to use those. You can use anything you want.
Okay.
So that might be a way. Try that. But again, I'd be a little cautious. It can go both ways, you know, when you use
strange.
Give me an example of a municipality where you saw this.
Well, I was in Pomona yesterday over the weekend, there was one there.
Well, I'd like to, if anybody's in Pomona listening, and a few people probably are, what is this free public Wi-Fi? Is this the city of Pomona doing it? Who's doing this? Where does it come from?
Yeah, I wonder. And it's usually a substantial signal, at least 2 bars.
You know, and I wonder if maybe they're starting to implement something and haven't yet finished it. I don't know. I mean, that's interesting. A lot of municipalities are starting to put these in. Maybe they just haven't connected it up to the internet. I don't know.
Yeah.
But there are a number of... one way to do this is maybe you're not getting a DNS. Maybe put in a DNS server. Or maybe it's just not working. Who knows what it is? Somebody in Pomona want to tell us? 1-800-520-1KFI. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy on KFI. Georgian Chino. Is it Chino or Chico?
No, it's Chino.
Chino, welcome to KFI.
Yeah, close to Pomona, but...
You don't have free public Wi-Fi in Chino?
No, everybody's probably using mine now that I hear what you said about the security.
Did you do
router.
That? Did you just take it out of the box, plug it in, and say, I'm done?
Yeah.
Sure, everybody does.
Yeah.
Sure. Now, let me tell you, it's very simple. Everybody should do this. I give away Wi-Fi. I think that's not a bad thing to do, but... When you do that, it means that anybody who's in the neighborhood can also see what you're doing on your network and has access to your network. So those are reasons you might not want to give away your Wi-Fi. And it's very simple. You just go into the interface, you know, on a Linksys. It's 192.168.1.1 on your browser. You surf into it. It'll say what to do in your manual. And then right on the front page there, you'll see turn encryption on. And you want to use WPA encryption. All you need. And then once you do that, the first time you try to use it, it'll say, what's the password?
Right.
Enter in the password that you made up, and it'll never ask you again, and you're secure. It's really simple.
Okay.
They should really put that in a big label on the box.
Right. Right.
What can I do for you today, George?
Oh, well, I've been, over the last month or so, I've been having trouble with my service provider.
Oh, boy.
As far as... I was using them, started up with them with dial-up like 6 years ago, but since then Verizon put the Fios into our neighborhood.
Oh, yeah.
So we went with that.
Sure you did, yeah.
And I've still got these guys out there, but now I got a letter the other day from a vendor that says, oh, your internet service provider says this is an illegal address. And if I go to their homepage and get their phone number there, and when you dial it, the voicemail box is full, so no more messages.
So in other words, this company basically went out of business.
They went somewhere. I crashed and burned.
You're not paying them any money, right?
Well, it's set up on our credit card, so it's every month's a thing.
All
plus,
right,
they've got our web page there.
So, oh, dear. Okay, so the first thing you want to do is download the web page. Get all the data.
Okay.
Because the next thing you're going to do is call the credit card company and say, discontinue this automatic payment.
Okay.
Then you'll probably hear from these guys at that point. Unless they've really gone out of business, in which case you won't hear from them anymore.
Yeah.
But the point is, you want to get your website first.
Okay.
And now, the domain, do you have a domain name, or is it just the domain name that came with your internet service?
Yeah, it's their domain name.
Okay, so
routes everything to us. Yeah,
You're going to be out of luck there. I mean, you're going to have to tell whoever goes to that web page, oh, don't use this address anymore.
Right.
What I would suggest doing for future is go to GoDaddy or one of the domain registrars, register a name, georgeandchino.com, and then point that to wherever you're hosting. And that way, if you'd done that, it'd be a simple thing just to discontinue that website and point it to somebody else, and the same address would continue to work.
Okay. Now sometimes it seems like it uses that address. Like, my wife will still get mail from there.
Interesting.
And then she'll do some, like, she uses Outlook Express, and I was using Outlook to try and keep our things separate.
Right.
If she scans a document in that she wants to email to somebody,
right,
and sends it, it ends up in my Outlook outbox. And I have to sign on and send it out, and it goes through these.
That's just the way the scanner's working, yeah. But see, these guys might have gone out of business, and still their servers might be running. This stuff will run without attention for quite some time.
Okay.
So I don't know what's the name of the company?
CISO.
I wonder what happened to them.
I don't know. The last we had contact with them was they had done some upgrading and new servers and things and were having some trouble, and that we were like one of the original accounts and they thought everything was okay. And then,
Small ISPs, it's a tough life.
They're
competing against people like Verizon and Fios.
Yeah.
And
right.
You're probably not the only people who dumped them. And maybe they just shuttered or went home. And the servers are still running. It could just be one computer in somebody's basement. And the guy never turned it off. At some point, he probably will. But I would certainly turn off the credit card charge, especially if you've tried to reach these people and written, maybe write them a letter. Maybe you call Bill Handel and find out how you get out of it. But it does sound like they've gone belly up. So get your website off of there. That's the main thing. Because as soon as they pull the plug, you've lost everything. Whatever's on those servers. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, KFI AM 640. More stimulating talk radio. It's 152.
KFI's big stories. We're on it.
Corey Lytle's wife and son could lose out on $1.5 million in insurance money if it's determined he was piloting the plane when it crashed into a Manhattan high-rise condo on Wednesday.
David Keith with the Oxnard PD says the 16-year-old girl's mom figured out what was going on and called the cops. Investigators got the girl to admit having sex with her coach, Jonathan Rios. He runs Club Cheer Twisters with his wife.
KFI AM 640. More stimulating talk radio.
I love high-speed internet. I tell you, I could never go back. I know there are still people who are not using it, who are using dial-up. And I just wonder, how do you do it? I guess if you've never tried high speed, you just don't know. But trust me, you're missing out on the revolution. You can't watch YouTube videos. You can't download music and TV. You can't do any of the stuff that everybody's doing now on the internet. You need high speed. Fortunately, it doesn't have to cost an arm and a leg. In fact, $14.95 a month is all it costs with DSL Extreme. Less than the cost of a car wash, $14.95 a month. And what do you get? You get high-speed internet from one of the best internet service providers in the country. They have spam filters, virus filters, a firewall, great 24-hour local tech support, absolutely free. And you know what? There's no setup fee. The modem is free. Just $14.95 a month. There are some geographic restrictions, though, so call 866-2-GET-NET, 866-2-G-E-T-N-E-T, or visit them online at dslextreme.com. High-speed internet doesn't have to cost an arm and a leg, and it's good stuff. It's the same stuff I use from a great internet service provider. Call DSL Extreme, 866-2-GET-NET, to get DSL Extreme.
Matt Drudge, tonight, 7 to 10.
KFI, AM 640.
.159 on KFI, AM 640. More stimulating talk radio. I am out of time. I wish I could stay another few hours. I'll tell you what, let's do this all again next week. 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. on KFI. We'll talk high tech. All week long, I'm online at twit.tv. That's where all the podcasts are, and there's some great stuff there. TWIT.TV. Dr. Dean Adel is coming up next. Have yourself a great Sunday afternoon and a great week. I'll see you next Saturday. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy, on KFI AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. It's 159. Lisa Osborne's in the KFI News Center. Well, that's it for this edition of The Tech Guy on KFI. Thanks so much for listening. If you're ever in the Southern California area, I hope you'll listen live on the radio every Saturday and Sunday from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. on KFI AM 640. You can also listen on the internet anytime at KFIAM640.com. Archives of older shows are available online on my website. That's leo.am. Click the audio archives button. And of course, you can subscribe to the podcast, which is leo.am/podcasts/KFI. My thanks to Howard Bailey for providing the theme music for this show. You can listen to Howard's music at soundclick.com. Thanks to DSL Extreme for providing the bandwidth. Of course, first of all, thanks to you for listening. I'll see you next time on KFI.